Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University College of General Studies titled Millennials and Linguistic Revolution, How Texting and Social Media Take Us Both Backward and Forward as Language Users in Modern America. Our speaker is Columbia University Associate Professor John McCorder. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, College of General Studies lecturer Stephanie Bitterbeer.
It's a genuine pleasure for me to introduce today's speaker, and not just because I have been hounding him for the past 3 years to pay us a visit and finally have proven victorious. Let me start by listing a few of Mr. McWhorter's academic credentials and achievements. Dr. John McWhorter is Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He previously was Associate Professor of Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He earned his BA from Rutgers University, his MA from New York University, and his PhD in linguistics from Stanford University. According to his own bio page, Professor McWhorter specializes in language change and language contact. And he's the author of more than a dozen books, actually more like 20, including The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language, Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, The Language Hoax, Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still Like Literally, and most recently, The Creole Debate. On a side note, I'm really hoping to pick his brain later about how to be as prolific as he is. But there's more. Mr. McWhorter also boasts a long and flourishing career as a public intellectual. He has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and the New Yorker. And he has been a public voice on a wide variety of social and cultural issues. He has offered us his views on anything from President Obama's use of the word thugs to our complicated relationship with hip-hop, to the issue of free speech on campus, and to now the new transgender pronoun day. I invite you above all to start, if you haven't already, to follow his writing, or if you prefer, to listen to his speaking. He has an excellent podcast, Lexicon Valley, that runs for Slate. But why have we brought Dr. McWhorter here? As students in the Boston-London program, which highlights our long and complex history as humans, you've undoubtedly learned about the origins of human language and the transition from oral to literate cultures. The question of how language shapes our thinking is a central one in all of our rhetoric courses. And it's exciting to think about our own current language use, our daily conversations, our tweets, our texts, our emails, and our social media messages as playing a role in how our thinking as a culture happens and might continue to evolve. But clearly, I can't speak to this issue nearly as eloquently as Mr. McWhorter himself, so I will very gladly pass on the mic to him and let you listen to his thoughts on millennial literacy. Let's all welcome Professor John McWhorter.
Thank you, folks. I want to talk to you all today about something that all of you are doing, which I find massively interesting, because I think that there is a transformation in the texture of American language that's happening, and a lot of people aren't noticing it, and it's getting to the point where it can be hard to remember that things were ever any different. But what I mean is a subset of what the title of this lecture is. And so I've been brought here by Professor Bitterbeer to talk about millennials and how they're changing the language for the better or for the worse. And I think there might be an expectation that what I was going to talk about was texting. And texting's nice. I find it very interesting. I even do it myself to an extent. And there is a kind of an informal grammar of texting that has arisen over a lot of you out there are texting right now, that has arisen over about the, I do it too, all the time during talks even, 12 or 15 years. But, you know, to tell you the truth, I've spoken about texting in a few venues already. Texting is not as novel as it used to be. And I care more about something else these days. So I want to share with you what I'm actually thinking about. And that's something that unofficially I am calling kid speak, and that's going to change, but it's something that's happening. It is delightfully changing what it is to express yourself articulately as an English-speaking person under a certain age. I'm afraid to think what that age is. And we need to give it a name. We need to think about it. And this is the sort of thing that I mean. This is one of the earliest examples. This started creeping into general usage just a few years ago and a bit. And we linguists call it the because X construction. And what I mean is if somebody says, well, the way that you know that this is true is because science. Now, that's technically not a legitimate sentence, but it is now because we use because that way all the time. Somebody will say something like, well, I tried to do it a different way, but it didn't work, and you know how it goes. It was all because busy. Not because I was busy, but because busy. That is technically almost a willful flouting of what's supposed to be the rules of the language. But of course, people are doing it to strike a certain tone of irony, a certain tone of humor. But the thing is, no one said because X before about 2013. No one wrote because X before about 2013. And what it is that when you say because hungry or because old or something like that, what you're doing is striking an almost childish note. The idea is that you're playing at being a child for a second in putting it that way. And that particular expression got around so much that the American Dialect Association in, I believe, 2015 gave because X the status of word of the year. It actually had become that established, and it hasn't gone away. So the because X construction is one of them. But if you listen closely to the language, you find other ones. And so, for example, about a year ago, I was at Columbia where I teach, and a woman who's in one of my classes was coming my way. She happened not to have come to the past two class meetings. And, you know, she's a good student, and she and I had a bantery kind of relationship. And so I said, well, I said, I didn't hit a piece of furniture when I did it. I said, well, Anna, And she said, oh, no, I've had all the illnesses. And I walked away laughing, and I was thinking, it's like she's had every sickness. That was very wittily put. And then I started listening, and I realized that I had heard a new expression. This was actually, quote, unquote, a thing. And so, for example, another student of mine was bragging about what an accomplished bird watcher his father is. And I know that's kind of a strange thing to be bragging about, but he is a magnificently strange person. So he's very proud that his father has seen every documented bird in the state of Georgia. And he was telling this to the whole class, and he said, well, my father, he's seen all the birds. And I thought to myself, there's that all the again, because has he really seen all of them? You know, especially all the birds in the United States, but even in Georgia, there are probably 16 billion birds. Really? Every kind of bird? And so that's when I asked, why did you put it that way? And the class chimed in. And a lot of you probably know that this business of saying I've had all the illnesses or all the birds or we're going to eat all the foods, that goes back to one charming comic strip by someone named Ali Brosh, where this weird little, almost sock puppety-looking figure talks about wanting to clean all the things. And this person ends up not being able to accomplish this cleaning all of the things. So this figure is, once again, saying something that you would associate with a child. The idea that you could clean everything in your house, all the things. You know that's not going to happen. But children's worlds are small. And so a child will walk up to you and say, well, in class, you know, Mrs. Turner showed us how to do flips, and then we were all laughing, and then we turned, and then we did that other turn and that other turn. You don't even know this kid. You don't know who Mrs. Turner is. You've never talked about what that other turn was, but the child thinks that you're in their head. That's one of the cutest things about people under 18. That's something that little kids do. Well, if you say all the things, it implies that you don't know yet how many things there are. Of course you do, but once again, it's striking the tone of a child for a second. It's fun to pretend to be a child. And there's a great deal of this going on, all sorts of other things. And so someone might say, for example, and it's not only people who are 18 or even 28, somebody about 40 said to me recently, "Well, back in that time, I was all pilly, and I found it was hard to get anything done." Pilly. Now, through context, I gradually learned that what he meant was that he had gone through a phase of using very potent pills for recreational, narcotic reasons. He had had certain problems with that. The way that he puckishly put it was to say that he had been pilly. No one would have put it that way 10 years ago. I'm 53. I'm old enough now to remember what is becoming a different time. There were other ways of being funny, but nobody would have said pilly. Listen around, and it's everywhere. Somebody will say about an argument they had with someone, "Oh, well, you know what it was like. Things got yelly. Things got yelly." I like the way that sounds, but that's new. That's a new way of using that suffix "-e," which usually we use, you know, to indicate something kind of diminutive. It's, once again, a childish way of putting things, call it silly, but it's everywhere, and it's used even in very strategic ways to avoid giving offense. Someone told me of another person who was thinking about moving to a different neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and they said, "We decided to move to that neighborhood because it isn't shooty stabby anymore." That's how the person put it. Now, what does that mean? If you know anything about the demographics and the history of Washington, D.C., you know that what this person was doing was trying to express a certain thought about a certain neighborhood that's populated by probably a certain group of people without giving too much offense. And so she's stepping around the sociology and the history and talking about it being shooty stabby. Once again, that's not the way that person would have put it 10 years ago. There's something new afoot in the way people are using language. Or this is my very favorite one, and I have no doubt that it is common among probably half of this room, and yet it's completely subconscious, but I swear to you that this is real. You're walking down the street, and somebody asks you, so how was the party? Now, if it's 1985, this person says, "Good," like that, "good." That's 1985. That person in 1985's daughter now is, you know, let's say at BU, so how was the party? The person will say, good, that. Or if somebody says, "Do you want this?" "No." And so you have these two syllables. You all know what I mean. When I was in college, that person said, "No." Now it's "No." I've seen an actress on stage who is now 32, where her line, Broadway actress, her line was supposed to be, "It was you." She's a very good actress. She's very good at using language in a natural fashion. I doubt if she thought about it. But the way she delivered the line was, "It was you." And I thought, that is so 2017. Yeah. That is something that is brand new. It is part now of a generation. You can see it in movies. You can hear it on NPR. You guys have probably been listening to it all day. I shouldn't say guys, because at this point, the people who are using this appended are mostly women. And there's a reason that it's mostly women. We're talking about a language change. And when something new pops up in a language, generally it's women who start it. Women are the innovators in language. Women are almost always ahead. And so if there's going to be a new thing, as we might call it, of saying, "It's up in the clouds," or "move," it's going to be women who do that because it's brand new. Men are much more uptight. Men don't push language along because, for reasons that nobody has quite documented, and this is all very subconscious, but to be a man is to not do creative new things to the language as much. The general pattern is that women start it, then it jumps the rails, and men pick it up. So this "move-a, you-a, good-a" is, by my reckoning, about 5 years old in terms of when it actuated, as linguists put it. And an interesting thing, I'm going to give you the real thing. At this point, if you listen around with what you might call a sociolinguist's ear, to this particular Yuwa Gudha. It is women, almost always under 35, although every now and then a woman who's maybe about 50 does it, because it jumps the rails in that way too. I have heard almost not a single straight man do it, except for Chidi on The Good Place, who does it in one scene, and I think that he's being arch, and also Ted Danson a few episodes later. And that's just TV. It's women and it's gay men. And gay men do not talk exactly like women, but there's an intersection. And so it's not surprising that of the men who are doing it in 2019, in my experience and that of other people who I've set on this, it is always a gay man. And so it's language change in progress. It's not just something weird happening. It's something that I'm sure people, hopefully not me, but people will be writing academic articles about, because it's really becoming part of the language. And once again, it is a kind of kid speak, even though it's completely subconscious. People have been saying no as little kids at least since the 1970s. I've been doing an informal study of this myself, and it's clear that kids doing that starts in the 1970s. The question is, why did a particular generation of women end up subconsciously holding on to it starting last week? That's the nature of language and how it changes. You never know what it's going to be. But it begins in the 70s with kids in the sandbox. Now it's at an intermediate point where it's women. Go about 20 years from now and guys will be doing it too. And 20 years after that, there will be people kind of getting old doing it. Now it sounds like a young person. There will be somebody going, move! Because time passed. That's how these things begin. Kidspeak is everywhere. And it's a new kind of English. And of course, nobody walks around using language this way all day long. We're not talking about the entire language suddenly going into this toddler mode. Rather, it's one element in the toolkit that a person can use. You code switch into this, both in speech and in writing, depending on what you're trying to get across. It often has an air of irony. And in a bit, I'll talk about another function that it seems to have. But it's become a new element in the toolkit. America more and more pretends to talk like a five-year-old. And the question is why? It's a very interesting phenomenon. And I think there are a lot of whys why things like this happen. And one of them, I sincerely believe, is that the world outside at this point is terribly frightening. We are living through nasty times. And the truth is that if you take your finger and put it anywhere on a succession of years, people are generally talking about how horrible things are in the news. I remember specifically when George W. Bush was president, it was very common at a party to say, God, I've never known it to be like this, when in fact people had been saying the same thing during the Nixon administration, during the Ford administration, during most of the Reagan administration, during the first, but generally that's how people talk. These days, though, is different. It really is bad. Worst news I've known in my 53 years. And we all know what I'm talking about. It's become something of a cliche. But if you look out into this world where there are certain things going on in Washington, the recession of 2008 still has effects. You think about whether or not you're going to get a job and whether or not you're going to get a job that you like. It's becoming quite clear that bees, bats, and frogs are not going to exist in 50 years. If you live on my latitude, you want your daughter to enjoy building a snowman, and it never really snows year after year after year. These are scary times. And I think that part of the new kidspeak is a subconscious response to that. You almost want to curl up in a ball. You would rather be a child instead of facing what is possibly awaiting you after college. And part of the reason that I suspect that's true is because The 1970s, the early 70s, really was a time when things were worse than even they usually had been. People were afraid in the early 70s. And to most of you, the early 70s sounds like, you know, 1942 to me. But in the early 70s, there was a frightening, paranoid idiot who was president. It was the same thing. And there had been various grisly political assassinations starting in the early 60s and continuing right up to the end of them. That's Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Robert Kennedy, and others. And there was frightening polarization between Republicans and Democrats as a prelude to what we have now. It was a nasty time. There was an energy crisis. I'm just old enough to remember feeling like you had to always turn the lights out because I had been told that electricity was going to run out. There were long lines for gas. It was scary in 1973. And slang in the early 70s got really goofy and childlike. It's the only time in the 20th century where that had happened. The 1920s is known for goofy slang, too. And so you said that something was the bee's knees if something was good. But most 20s slang was cocky. And so there were all sorts of expressions that you used to ridicule people. You called people a wet blanket. That starts in the 20s when somebody is no fun at a party. You talked about how somebody knows their onions, and that means that they really know what they're doing. I don't know why it was onions, but that was the way that you praised somebody. It was cocky. It was pert. Whereas in the 70s, slang got charmingly stupid. I don't find kids speak stupid, but slang in the 70s got kind of stupid. And so, for example, you talked about giving people warm fuzzies. The idea being, don't be mean. You're going to give somebody a warm fuzzy. What is that? You know, I remember first time hearing that, and even though I was a child, thinking, isn't that a little saccharine? You know, giving somebody a warm fuzzy. Or you called people things like freakazoids. There were all these outer space terms like, wow, that's far out. And you're supposed to be thinking about being in outer space, but you weren't in outer space. You were in Philadelphia. Nobody was in space. And yet all of these things about being freaked out and far out and freakazoid and the warm fuzzies, all these things, look at slang in the various decades online, and you will giggle at the sorts of things people said with a straight face in the 1970s. Also, this might surprise you, nobody was using the word fluently until the 1970s. That one is a lot newer than you think. If you ever see anything taking place in 1932 where somebody says, that's wrong. That was not what it would have been. They would have called the person something else. In the 70s was fresh. Some people used it in the late 60s. It became common coin in the 70s. We're so used to now that it might as well be a pronoun. But in the 70s, I remember when it started, I remember thinking, why are we calling somebody a butthole? Why are they an anus? That was goofy, too. That was more of this 70s slang. Only in that decade would asshole have taken off the way it did, although it's blunted at this point. And so part of kidspeak, I think, is because the world sucks, and you just want to curl up in a ball and use language in the way that children do when they don't know what's going on yet. Perfectly understandable. There's another reason that I think that kidspeak has taken off recently. And I think it's something related to what I just said, which is that your generation, and yes, I have to speak as a now aging person, your generation has a different way of looking at adulthood than any generation documented before. There was a time when if you were 18 or 19, you were itching to be a grown-up. If you were a guy, you were looking forward to putting on a fedora and smoking a pipe and killing yourself. If you were a woman, you were looking forward to becoming a mother. That was the mores of the time. You were looking forward to being like your mom. The idea was not that you wanted to stay as a child. You didn't want to continue being a teenager. It was frustrating to be a teenager. You wanted to get beyond that. That was the general way that one thought. That was the message of the popular culture. That's changed these days. There have been some very interesting studies done that show that people who are 25 and below have a very ambivalent relationship to growing up. And it's completely understandable why. You're afraid you're not going to get a job. You're afraid there aren't going to be any bees. You're afraid of all sorts of things. And so there's a notion that you wouldn't mind staying doing just what you're doing, that it would be nice to perhaps always live with your parents, that it would be nice maybe if college extended for 6 or 7 years, that you don't want to be mom and dad, because mom and dad don't look like they're having that much fun. You're not sure if mom and dad are even going to live to see their 70s or 80s. And so, that kind of study showing that people of your generation express feelings of that kind regularly would also predict that a seasoning in the way that we speak involves talking like a child, that you use that particular voice. I think we're more into children these days in terms of the sense of protection that we get when we think about them than we ever have been before. And so the world around us is one where we would almost predict that there might arise a fashion of talking in the genres of childhood. You would almost wonder why it didn't happen. In the same way as, if you look at the slang of the 1970s, you can almost predict that what was going on in the larger world must have been pretty scary, because why all of a sudden did people start talking in that bubblegum way? And so, these things happen, and I think we are in that sort of period. But then there's something else about kids speak, and it's the kind of thing that makes us realize that the way we're often taught about language is a very narrow perspective on what this thing is that we do. So let's say that you grow up speaking English and you take Spanish and you sit through 4 or 5 years of classes and you've learned all these endings and you've learned that the adjective usually comes after the noun. And you figure, okay, I got it. And you use usted to be polite, and tú is informal, isn't that different? And you figure, that's how languages differ from one another. Then you try to learn some Chinese, and you don't, really, because it's just too different from English, because you're waiting for it to be like Spanish with the endings and everything, but it doesn't have that. It's so different in so many ways, and very often you feel like nobody can tell you how to crack the code. The reason for this sort of problem that we often have learning languages is because we're given a sense of language learning that's based mostly on how people taught Latin 300 years ago. And that really can only take you a short way to understanding how to express yourself in another language. And a lot of the reason why these things run you into a wall, a lot of what's missing is something that linguists call pragmatics. Jargon can be such a bother. And the fact that this is called pragmatics is tragic, because that tells you nothing about what it is. If anything, pragmatics sounds boring, and so you kind of want to turn away. Well, it's pragmatic. That sounds like a baked potato. Who cares? But pragmatics is actually one of the funnest aspects of what language is. It's what the attitude is behind what you're saying. And so on the one hand, you say, you park the car. And we all know what you and park and the and car mean. But the thing is, you wouldn't say you park the car. Or if you would, there's a whole lot more to it than just the you-ness, the parkness, the the-ness, and the car-ness. What's the attitude behind what you're saying? Why are you saying it? What are you trying to get done? There are all sorts of thingies in any language that allow you to go from being a robot to being a real person. It's the pragmatic markers. And what a lot of this kid speak is, if somebody was looking at this and thinking, well, why is it that all of a sudden everybody's talking like they're 5 years old? This annoys me. They're missing the point in that what it is not people talking like they're 5 years old. Kid speak is, in the pragmatic sense, about softening. If you don't know your softeners, then you're not speaking. You can know all about hablo, hablas, habla, but if you don't know how to take it back a little bit when you need to, then you're either a robot, 3 years old, or friendless. You have to be able to use the softeners. Now, what do I mean by that? It's things that nobody tells you about, nobody picks out, and so you don't know you're doing it. For example, let's say you're at a party. It's a bad one, and you wish to not be at the party. Now, how do you escape that situation in a way that will ensure that you'll be invited to that person's next party and be bored again? How do you not
insult that person?
Well, one thing that you might think is that you say, I'm leaving. But if you think about it, that's impossible. You do not walk up with your empty glass and say, I'm leaving. You would never be invited back. You would leave without anybody's phone number. So that doesn't work. I has a meaning. Leave has a meaning. That's not speaking English. So what really do you say? You might tell a foreigner that the way to do it is to say, I'm leaving. But what you would say in modern American English, and this should be in books, but it isn't, is I'm going to head out. You have to say that. If you don't say, I'm going to head out, and you have to put that little crackle in it, I'm going to head out. If you don't say head out, then you are leaving very abruptly. I personally don't like to say, I'm going to head out. It doesn't feel like me, so often I just fade into the wall and go, because you can't walk up to the host and say, I shall leave now. I'm going to take my departure. Head out is the softened version of depart, and you use it a lot more than you would ever use depart. Or somebody writes you something. I wanted to check back about the issue of the missing ticket. I wanted. Why the past tense? Because they want to right now. They still do. So why are they telling you that last week they were in that state of want? Why not, I want to check about the ticket. See, that's too abrupt. You can't say, I want to check about the ticket. It's grammatical. You'd be understood. If the person were new to the language or a child, you would let it by. But you have to say, I wanted to. You're referring to it as if it was in the past, which is a softener to avoid the directness of saying that really it's that there's something that's dragging out too long and you want right now in this instance to fix it. There are countless things in the language that I'm speaking right now that are absolutely necessary to being a person where a grammar would never tell you, but that's because grammarians don't think about the pragmatics, as it were. For those of you who are Chinese, think about yixia. Yixia. If you don't use yixia, you are not a human being. English has its yixias, and just like in our books, yixia is never taught right. No book would teach a Chinese speaker to say head out, and so then you don't get invited back to the party. That's the thing. Kids speak, because now you're all wondering, I thought this was about millennials. Okay, here we go. Kids speak is softening. That's the function of a lot of it. And so if somebody says, you know, if they don't want to seem obnoxious in letting everybody know that their father has seen every variety of bird in Georgia, because we all know how prestigious that accomplishment is, then you're going to say, my father has seen all the birds, because it sounds like you're being a kid for a second. So that's a way of being proud of dad without pushing it in people's faces. Or if you're going to say something like, well, there was a time when I was all pilly, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a way of saying that in mixed company instead of saying, there was a time when I was addicted to narcotics. You don't say that. We all knew what he meant, but saying I was pilly was a way of putting it out there without stopping the conversation cold. It was a softener. It was very deft. And so we've gotten to the point where we have a whole register, as we call it, that you can slip into to soften in the way that you soften by saying you wanted to do something that you want right now, or that you use when you say you're going to head out, when really it's not going to be that slow and random. You're going to turn around and walk right out the door. So it's the 70s. It's being afraid to grow up. It's also just new softening equipment. And the truth is that the language of people under about 35 is, in that way, very polite. So many people miss that a lot of the new things are not mistakes, they're politeness. And so all the use of the word like, for example, it's very common to hear somebody say, these damn kids use like every five words. It disgusts me. But the truth is, if you actually take down what somebody's saying, who does use like about every five words, a lot of the likes are ways of taking the sting out of things. If you tell somebody, this is the only way to do it, well, you're pretty direct. If you say, this is like the only way to do it, you're a human being. Or if someone says, there were so many people in there that we couldn't even do my bar mitzvah, it sounds peevish. This is something I actually overheard. If you say, there were so many people like in there that we like couldn't even do my bar mitzvah, he sounds like he rolls with the punches. And so there's an articulateness in like. There's a whole book about like. It's 300 pages, and it's almost readable, and I recommend it. It's actually very complicated and very interesting. The woman who studied it is becoming known among linguists as the like lady. We're very clever people. And so, like is much more interesting than we think, and it's very polite. The use of totally. So, oh, we're totally going to get tickets. What does the totally mean? Does the totally mean that you're going to get tickets in a comprehensive way? No. Oh, we're totally going to get tickets. If you listen to how it's used, you realize that it means something that's actually very sweet. He's totally going to call you. Okay, does that mean that he's going to flex his muscles and make a truly complete telephone call? No. So why totally? He's totally going to call you. What that means is there are people who think that he's not going to call you, but you and I know for various reasons that he is. Now, you don't think of it that way, but totally is going into somebody's head and giving a little nod. It's a kind of warm fuzzy in a way. And so he's totally going to call you is a very sweet thing to say to somebody. Totally is polite. And so kid speak is a new kind of politeness. It's not just some sort of act. It's a way of talking in a way that avoids giving offense. That's a nice thing. So you heard it here first and probably last, that there is something that we can call kid speak or something else. And it sounds very normal now, but if you were a time traveler back to, say, even 2003, in 2003 there was something called an iPod, but it was kind of like an iPhone. People were drinking this terrible wine, yellowtail wine. Yellowtail wine tastes like something squeezed out of a sponge. But any party you went to before you headed out, you had to drink yellowtail wine. It was a very different time. But it wasn't, really. Everything was pretty much the same. You had psychotherapy. You had political conflict. You had Viagra, tall buildings. All of it was there. But this kid speak was brand new. This kid speak is something that I have never heard proliferate so much in my lifetime. And I think that some people would think that it means that the language is falling apart. But really, what it means is that the language is enriched. It's like a symphony where you can take sounds from an earlier stage of music and you can sprinkle them in and give new meanings to them while also working in the modern forms. It really makes American English better. We are living in what will be called the good old days in about 50 years. You guys are creating the good old linguistic days. I salute you for it, and I have just told you officially what you are. Thank you very much. So, Stephanie, is this the part where I answer questions?
Yes.
Okay. Sir.
Hi. Enjoyed the lecture.
Thank you.
So you talked a lot about how this kind of baby language that we're developing here sort of softens the blow of potential insults and seemingly kind of meanders around a point you're trying to make to make it seem less abrupt. Mm-hmm. I could see some issues with that. Some, you know, maybe our language becomes less direct and less about getting things done and more about, you know, what kind of relationship we're cultivating with people mm-hmm. that we don't want to offend. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is that, in your perspective, more of an issue or a benefit to our language?
If I understand the question, it's a benefit. It's good to have ways of being polite. And often the ways that we're polite are more subconscious than things like say please and thank you. And so I would say that if there's a value judgment to be made, it's positive in that anthropologically there's a gentleness with the way people talk to each other that there was less of, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
So maybe I follow up a little bit. So do you think at all that possibly our language might, like people might use more words to convey the same meaning or convey the same want or pretend, like whatever language you'd use to ask someone to get something done kind of thing, mm-hmm. become less efficient? Or do you think that would resolve itself in some way?
Well, I'm not sure what efficient would mean in a language when we're talking about such small differences in how long it takes to say something. Probably to be polite means to add something. It's not going to be to subtract it, usually. But in terms of efficiency, you have to be careful because some languages have so much more junk that they drag along than others. And I don't think we'd want to say that anybody who speaks any particular language has an inefficient language. And so, you know, English, to you and me, this language feels normal. But the truth is that English is relatively telegraphic compared to probably most languages in the world. So it's a tough judgment, efficiency, although I take your point.
All right, thank you for your talk. So you say that KidSpeak arises as a response to living through trying times, and so surely the United States is the only place experiencing trying times, so English in, say, England. Do we see this happening concurrently or at other different periods?
I don't know, and that's something that I actually have been meaning to investigate. It's funny about the subtleties. If I say have been meaning, that implies that I don't really mean it. And that I'm never going to do it. So let me rephrase it. That is something which I shall investigate. Because if it's true, then you would find at least some sort of rough correlation, possibly, between how things are going in a particular country and whether or not this sort of thing is happening. Although there's also a chance element in where anything is going to go in a language. And so maybe it would be reflected in some other cultural practice of theirs. But it'd be interesting to know, and particularly in Britain, whether or not, one, it's the things that are happening here, and two, whether they've got ones of their own. And it's also hard to ask because these things are subconscious. But the Yuwa-Noah thing has jumped the ocean. They are now doing that, although it started here. It's funny how those things happen. So as you can see, the way I'm talking around it, I don't know yet, but I'm not dead yet, and I'm interested. And so I'm working this up into an academic paper nobody will read, and I am going to look into that.
Thank you.
So you should read it. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you for the lecture. I thought it was very informative and entertaining.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask, do you think this softness in our generation, do you think it like contributes to the fact that we're like, a lot of us are afraid to grow up? Do you think that contributes to that like fear in a way?
Part of it. Yeah, I think that you might say that the world seems so frightening that you might want to walk softly, and that might be part of it. To be a little less chummy, I think that part of it is also that we are so sociopolitically frayed that a lot of us can be afraid to say anything too vigorously. You don't want to step on toes, you don't want to get jumped on, and so you soften. I suspect that that's part of it as well. There's a kind of an organic relationship with a lot of these things.
All right, thank you. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.
How's it going? I appreciate you for coming out. So I know that when it comes to a lot of these linguistic trends, the South tends to sort of trail behind a little bit with the way that it changes. So I'm from Texas, right? So I haven't heard a lot of the things that you talked about too much. But one thing that I did notice that I encountered more here than I ever had back home was the whole thing about upspeak, which I'm sure that's, you know, enough material for a whole nother talk. But do you think that that's at all connected to this as well, what you were speaking of today, or is that a separate sort of issue?
The uptalk is a very interesting phenomenon where you're making a statement and you couch it as if it was a question. And the reason that I didn't mention it is because it happens to be much older than these things. That started, and I kid you not, that started with white sorority sisters. It's documented. There's an uptalk lady, although she isn't called that. And it started there, and then only women were doing it. And then men started doing it, and now it's universal to most of the United States. And that all happened in the 80s and 90s. So that was its own thing. And believe it or not, it was first documented in Australia, of all places. But yes, uptalk is just there. That is something that can immediately let you know whether somebody was born after a certain date or before. But you're saying you hadn't noticed it in Texas?
Not nearly as much. And actually, this sort of connects. I just randomly thought about that. Do you think there's any reason that you know why it is that the South tends to trail behind with a lot of these things, or is it just like that?
To tell you the truth, the South is not known for kind of dragging behind in these things.
Okay.
It's that the South is its own region in many ways, and so there are all sorts of things that are probably going on in Texas that nobody happens to be writing about, because a lot of this research does come from the Northeast and California. But no, there's no particular Southern lag. So much happens that you never know. Here's a quick example. In the 1920s and 30s, kids, to my knowledge, white kids, but I don't know, white kids in high schools in southern Texas liked to call each other Doc. It was something that came and went. What's up, Doc? That was slang. One of them helped create Bugs Bunny, and so now we know what's up, Doc. Yes. If there were no Bugs Bunny, we would not know that there was that slang in Texas. Things were moving along. Those people are all now dead or eating through a straw, and so they're not going to tell us. I'm sorry. But they would all be 100. And so they're gone, but all sorts of things happen that nobody documents. You should listen to your world, because I'll bet there's... I'm going to bet you something. Let's make a bet. In your living place, there are things going on that are equivalent to kid speak that are different from the ones that I mentioned, that just nobody talks about because they don't happen to be at Boston University. That's my guess.
All right. Well, that was interesting. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The South does not drag behind.
Thank you for the lecture. You had mentioned a lot of things that goes to show that this kid talk is almost like an unconscious like defense mechanism. So as individuals, how would we avoid using that as a self mechanism, or how do we just avoid this kid talk in general?
I don't think you should avoid it. I think it is a fantastic enrichment of the language, and I'm not saying that because, you know, maybe somebody's paying me to say it. I think this is great. Now, I will openly say that all of us should know that there are ways that you talk formally and ways that you talk informally. So if you're talking formally, you don't talk about elderly people eating through straws, all sorts of things that you don't do. And in that vein, you don't say like every 5 words. You don't say my father knows all the birds. And I think anybody knows that there are things that you don't say when you're trying to sound like you have some kind of authority. But no, I don't think it should be changed at all. When it goes away, I'm going to be eating through a straw and feeling that English isn't as much fun. That is sincere. Don't stop.
Okay.
Keep doing it.
Thank you.
Hello, I'd like to thank you for coming out to BU. I think we all appreciate it. Do you think the emergence of more polite or softer conversational or interpersonal motifs, do you think that's a way to compensate for a more vitriolic political climate?
Yeah. I do. I think that part of it is that we are so afraid of our political climate. These are nasty, nasty times. I think we're all hunkering down. I mean, I use some of these expressions, and I can feel in myself, and of course, random personal testimony is the equivalent of science. I can feel in myself that part of it is because the world frightens me. Yeah, definitely. That's my hypothesis.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. You know, the bats really are dying. There are not going to be any bats in the United States in about 50 years. Have you ever seen a bat? They're mice with wings. They're adorable. And they're all dying of this disease. And it's the president's fault.
Okay, my question is, you were talking about how the times that we live in encourage us to speak with a kind of empathy for one another and, like, the politeness in our language. But how does that translate into, like, the stratification of, like, how society is and, like, the different, like, classes or the situations that people live in? How does that differ, I guess, or, like...
Do you mean, is there a class stratification in this?
Like, the language, how does this... Does it apply to everyone? Or, like, people who are in worse situations than other people, is it more prominent or less prominent? Or, like...
That's a wonderful question. What you're asking leads me to think about whether an individual who's having a very difficult life might be given to doing this sort of thing more than an individual who's having a happy life or something like that, which is not only something that I have been meaning to but not investigate. I had never thought about it at all. And in terms of society, say, are we talking about whether there would be more softening among people who are threatened with unemployment and living in dangerous communities or living on the edge, as opposed to somebody who lives in Scarsdale, New York, or Brookline, Massachusetts? That would be something interesting to look at, and I genuinely mean interesting to look at. Now, it could disprove my thesis, but even if it didn't, just to see the variation would be interesting.
Hello. We enjoyed having you here. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
I noticed you mentioned the like effect of the particular mean, like all the things, which I know is very old. And I was just wondering if since then there has been documentation or research done on the effects of like mass culture among youth and how that shapes language, especially with like Vine references or memes. Like everyone knows, like back at it again at Krispy Kreme, you know, like that conveys now a whole new meaning and how that has shaped language.
Yeah. Yes, there is just now beginning to be a literature about this, and I can refer you to something coming, which is a book called Because Internet, and it's coming out in July, and it's by Gretchen McCullough, who does a podcast called Lingthusiasm, which is the second best linguistic podcast, and it's called Because Internet, and I've got a copy of it. It's excellent. And in 250 pages, you will learn about that sort of thing and the literature as well. Because, yes, it's all happening right now. A lot of it happens on social media. A lot of it happens within pop culture products. And what's interesting is how it just jumps out. So that comic strip would have just been a comic strip in 1970. Now that thing can be online, and you and I are both mentioning it, and that's it's happening all the time. The speed is amazing. But Because Internet, I think, is going to be the first book that captures what you're talking about. And it'll be obsolete in 10 seconds. But Gretchen is onto this. So read her book.
Okay, thank you. I will.
You're welcome.
All right. So I think that concludes this long series of questions. This is great. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Columbia University Associate Professor John McCorder. Professor McCorder's lecture was titled Millennials and Linguistic Revolution, How Texting and Social Media Take Us Both Backward and Forward as Language Users in Modern America, and was presented by the Boston University College of General Studies. Tonight's moderator was College of General Studies lecturer Stephanie Bitterbeer. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lindotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.